history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really need to be told, and we're always better off when we take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we go down that road, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Grover Beach, California, beautiful spot on the Central California coast. And I'm in the home of Ray and Elma Lloyd. They've only been married 72 years, so they've got a ways to go. Ray's 95 years old now, and when he was 17, he joined the Navy, served on a cruiser and a carrier in World War II. We're going to hear about that. But let's start out, Ray, with your childhood in Bakersfield, California. I'm sure it was a little smaller then than it is now. What do you remember about growing up in the 20s and 30s in Kern County?
Well, when I was a young kid there in Bakersfield, there was a streetcar line that ran from East Bakersfield to West Bakersfield and sagebrush in between. I went to grammar school and junior high at Washington Junior High, and then I was in the first graduating class of East Bakersfield High. That was the second high school that they had in Bakersfield. I understand they got a lot more now. But anyway, when I graduated from high school, I was 17 years old. I went to work for the Southern Pacific Railroad in East Bakersfield, and I worked till the 4th of July, and then I went down and went to the Navy. And I joined the Navy, and I ended up being transferred to Hawaii, went aboard the heavy cruiser Portland. And when I got there, they assigned me to a Marine sergeant that was gun captain on an open deck 5-inch gun. And he wasn't very happy with having a 17-year-old kid on his gun crew, but there I was, the only sailor in the gun crew. He sent me with a Marine up to teach me what to do on the gun. And that was my battle station the whole time I was on the cruiser.
Well, and let me rewind just a little bit for you, because it seems like everybody remembers something about December 7th, 1941, whether they were in the service yet or not. That seems to be one of those moments that created a memory for people. You remember where you were and how you found out about Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, I was at home. We lived in the 800 block on Oregon Street there in East Bakersfield. And that's when I first heard about it. And then, of course, everybody was listening to the radio. And then all the newspapers come out with extras. And the kids were walking up and down the street hollering, "Extra papers for sale." That was my main memory, because you only saw them sell papers on Sunday on the street. But they was out there for two or three days pretty heavy with the extras that were always coming out. And that's about my memory of that opening day anyway. And I know when we went to school, everybody was talking about the war. And one thing I've never forgot, I had this teacher. He said he couldn't understand why the Japanese would attack a country like ours, because they were such a small country. And he said all they had was bamboo sticks and a sword maybe. Well, I got another education when I got out in the Pacific. They had a lot more than that.
And we're going to hear about that and hear how close some of that came to you. And you described for us getting onto that gun crew, being a sailor and really a Marine's job. And the reason there isn't a Marine gunner there is that guy got killed, right? Or hurt?
Lost some men, yeah. Anyway, on the gun crew, I did my job, but the sergeant in charge, he never gave me the time of day. He considered that a personal insult, and I don't blame him. When you been through what he'd been through already and didn't have somebody like me come on his gun crew. But anyhow, I stayed in there. We were a raider for a while, and we shot up some shipping in Tarawa. And then we escorted the Hornet and the Enterprise in the Battle of Santa Cruz Island. And we came through that all right, but we lost the Hornet. It was sunk, and I think a destroyer or two. But we came through that, and then we ended up going to Guadalcanal, We'd lost three cruisers there, to Astoria, to Vincennes, and to Quincy. Halsey was upset about that because they thought the war was over, and one of them actually had anchored for the night when the Japanese fleet came down and wiped them out. So he put out an order when he was in so many miles of Guadalcanal, you had to be at general quarters. So we were steaming there with some cargo ships trying to get some supplies to the Marines because they were just barely hanging on. We had three cargo ships. And let's see, the San Francisco, the Helena, the San Juan, and the Juno was with us. If you recall, the Juno was with the five brothers on it.
Mm-hmm. The five Sullivan brothers. And the Juno was sunk, the Helena was sunk, and the San Francisco was damaged pretty badly, too. So how'd you guys escape all that?
Well, we had the whole stern shot off and took a few shell hits. And, of course, we were out of control, and it was a night surface battle. All you could see was gun flashes and explosions and fires. It went on a very short time because the Japanese didn't have any radar at the time, so they didn't know how many ships they were fighting, and they had us way outnumbered. But anyway, they broke it off and took off. So we were there in the morning when the sun come up, or daylight, where we could see, and there was a damaged Japanese destroyer in there with us, and we sank that, and there was a Japanese battleship damaged over at by Savo Island, and the planes from Guadalcanal started bombing it right away, finally sunk it. So we drifted around there all day, and of course there were a lot of survivors in the water. We had cargo nets over the side, and they were trying to bring the guys up out of the water. It was all covered with oil and what have you. So anyway, this went on for a while, and then all of a sudden radar picked up air raid coming in on us. The captain just kicked her in full bore, and we went right through those guys, just like he was mowing hay in our wild circle, because that's all we could go in. And the planes from Henderson Field, they fought off the planes, so they never got to us. We went back to picking up survivors, and our two scout planes we'd launched the day before, because they knew we was going to have some kind of action that night, and they were fabric in those days, the scout planes, and so they were taxiing around picking up survivors, and the guys was climbing on the wings and everything, and the planes were wrecks by the time they got a plane load, guys hanging on and everything, coming over next to us and get off. But anyway, we got through picking up survivors, and the Marines started coming out and landing barges and getting the rest of them. Then we was pushed around there by a tug called the Bobolink, and they were trying to get us to Tulagi Island because the Marines had taken that island. They hadn't secured Guadalcanal by a long shot. So this went on, and daylight got dark, and they were still trying to get us over there. And then our own American PT boat started challenging us. They wouldn't accept that we were an American ship, so one of them ended up firing four torpedoes at us, but the wreckage was dragging in the water and made it look like we was making 40 knots. They, of course, misjudged by the speed, so they missed us. Then one of the officers from the tug got in a small boat and went out there and identified everybody. And so then we got in and we tied up to a couple of coconut trees there up against the bank. Soon as the sun come up, sent working parties ashore, cutting limbs and everything off the trees and bushes, and they brought them back and we piled them all over the ship, camouflaging the ship with these limbs and stuff. And we were in there for, I don't know exactly how many days now, but they flew a crew in a PBY that were underwater welders, divers and stuff. They started cutting the wreckage loose and got their rudder positioned to where they hoped it would straight. So they welded in that position. And then that night we took off, and it wasn't enough. The tug couldn't pull us. We kept pulling away from it all the time. So we had to go back in. Sun come up the next day. Divers went back down. They readjusted the rudder and welded it again. Then we took off that night. But the sad part of that whole deal was the PBY that was flying the divers in with all their equipment was taken off. And I don't know what happened. Anyway, it crashed, killed a whole bunch of them. So we lost all those divers and the pilots. But we took off, and everything worked out well. And they towed us to Sydney, Australia. When we got to Sydney, Australia, I had port and starboard liberty, and I happened to be on the first to go ashore. We'd gone into dry dock there at a place called Cockatoo Island in Sydney Harbor. I went ashore with the first liberty party, half the crew. I came back the next morning, and a kid I went through boot camp with was sitting there, and he looked like a ghost, and I knew something was the matter, and I said, "What is the matter?" And then he started telling me how when they started pumping the water out of the dry dock, and of course the water was going down in the ship, the doctor came and got him, and they went down and started getting the bodies out. I'm not going into the detail, but that's what they did. He was in pretty bad shape because he was one of the guys down there. So I missed out on that, fortunately. But anyway, when we were in Sydney, all the new crew members were transferred off. And we got off in Sydney and got on a train to head for Perth, which is on the east coast of Australia. And we rode the train, cattle cars, with our duffel bags and stuff piled up in front to break the wind. We'd huddle in there. I guess there was probably about 15 or 20 of us. And every time we came to the state line, I think there's six or seven states there, they would have to change trains because each state had its own gauge. So we had to, anyway, we got to Perth and their small town of Fremantle. That's where our advanced submarine base was. And we had the ship Peleus in there was a sub tender. So they were coming in there for repairs and going back out. And our job was maintenance in the motor pool. And that's where I was stationed in. I was there for probably 3 or 4 months and I got diphtheria. And I ended up in a hospital, and I finally got out of there. And then by the time I got back, I was transferred back to the States. And then I was put on the aircraft carrier Kitkin Bay, new construction.
That's a lot of action that you just described. And you described it very matter-of-factly. I know you've told that story before, but a lot of questions came to mind for me because I'm trying to imagine myself as this tall 17-year-old kid from Bakersfield who all of a sudden is out in the Pacific on a cruiser and seeing things that he's never seen before and that probably nothing could prepare him for. So you mentioned you guys are there on the Portland when the Hornet gets sunk, the USS Hornet, which had launched Doolittle's Raiders on their raid to Tokyo. You're there as a teenager watching big giant aircraft carrier get sunk. Was that hard to see and understand?
Well, when the carrier battles, you just saw planes. You never saw the enemy. You just saw their planes. And I knew the Hornet was hit, but when I was a loader, I was able to look around some. But when I was a pointer, I wasn't able to look around because I was on the scope. But I was able to catch a glimpse now and then, and it was unbelievable. And that was the early stages of the war, and the Japanese pilots were sharp. And they would be down flat on that ocean, and they'd come right at you, and then they'd climb up and dive, or they'd drop torpedoes, whatever they was going to do. And, of course, when the ship is hit, you pretty well know that it was off our port side and the Enterprise. Our job was to stay on her port side and take any torpedoes that they thought was going to hit the Enterprise. We were fortunate that we didn't have to take any, but that was our job, one of the main jobs, because the carriers were the heart of the fleet. But when the Hornet went down, we just went off and left her. The destroyer stayed with her to pick up crew and what have you, but that's the last that I saw of her when she was dead in the water. And it's unbelievable the turns and the twists that that Enterprise would make when these dive bombers are coming down on her. Just unbelievable the amount of wake and stuff of all the ships. The whole ocean was stirred up, and there'd be white water going clear up over her flight deck on some of that stuff. That's how hard she was turning. She just looked like she was spinning around in a circle. But that's what you had to do when you had dive bombers coming down on you. So it was a sight to see.
And I'm sure when you signed up, you didn't think this was going to be just an adventure or just a game. But was there a moment when it really kind of sank in for you that your life was in danger?
Yeah, that come early when we were a raider, and I saw that incoming, and it hit right alongside of us. I decided right then and there that the war was on because I could see what had happened. But anyway, I was fortunate enough. I never got a scratch. But at Guadalcanal, I might not have mentioned it, when the torpedo hit, there was a ton of wreckage, steel up in the air, and it started coming down. and I didn't know what was going on because I was trying to load the gun when the torpedo hit, and it knocked me down, and I lost the projectile. And I got up, and there was another explosion that lit things up, and I saw two Marines laying underneath the scarf of the smokestack. So I dove in on top of them because I knew something was happening, the steel coming down, but it wiped out the center of the gun crew. Then when the stuff stopped falling, I got up and started. I had a live projectile rolling around there somewhere, and I started crawling around the dark trying to find it, which I did. And about that time, I heard the sergeant say to a Marine, "Where's the replacements for the gun crew I sent you after?" And the Marine says, "They're all dead." That's the last communication I remember, other than I think that the sergeant put me on alert search, which is out on the splinter shield, keeping your eyes open to see what's going on. I think that's what happened, but the rest of that night is gone as far as I can remember until the sun come up, and that's when I noticed the blood on my shoes was probably a half inch deep, but all that stuff was taken care of. I don't remember what happened.
And when you say the blood on your shoes was a half inch deep, you mean there's a puddle of blood from all the guys who've been killed?
That's what it had to be, because the Marines, you know, they take care of their Marines, and they got them out of there. So whatever took place there, it's pitch black. You couldn't see anything unless there was an explosion that light up something for a second, and then you was blind again. Anyway, the gun crew was never the same. That's the last time the Marines had a full complement on the gun, and then shortly after that was all sailors. So I don't know how many we lost, because their quarters was away from wherever I was. When I went aboard, the ship had never had a chance to get more bunks or anything for all the added crew, wartime crew. So all I had was a blanket, and I always slept up by the gun. So when general quarters sound, I was already there. And I'd just lay on the deck on top of a blanket. I'd shove my shoes under the blanket for a pillow, and that's where I'd sleep at nighttime. That's where I was. I never did have a bunk the whole time I was on the ship, leave alone the locker. So that's how many men they had on there and how many bunks they had, but just didn't add up.
It's time for our first break, but we'll get into some more of the close calls Ray Lloyd survived during World War II when we get back. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.